The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the October issue of Our State magazine, which is featuring articles all about North Carolina's mountain region healing after Helene. And first up is the article is called Eye on the Storm. A retired professor, a veteran NPR broadcaster, and a senior at NC State became the go-to sources that help keep thousands in Western North Carolina informed, safe, and secure. Here are their stories. And we'll start with Ethan Clark, North Carolina's weather authority. A college student's passion for meteorology helped save lives and direct aid to residents reeling from the destructive force of Helene. As he pored over meteorological models in the small bedroom of his college apartment, Ethan Clark was becoming concerned. He opened Facebook and typed the following post. Dated Sunday, September 22nd, 9:49 a.m. Tropical update. Let me address the elephant in the room, and that's the high possibility of tropical development along the Gulf Coast this week. We can't really afford any more rain in many parts of the state. No reason to panic. I'll guide you through it like I always have. Clark is a senior at NC State, studying environmental science with a concentration in meteorology, natural disasters, and climate change, but he's been a weather enthusiast since a snowstorm blew through his hometown of Raleigh when he was 10. Excuse me. Inspired to learn more about predicting the weather, he went to the school library and checked out books on the subject. The next year, he volunteered to be the weather person on his school's news broadcast. He then learned to forecast the weather by reading books and taking online classes. In seventh grade, he started the Ethan Weather Facebook page, now North Carolina's Weather Authority, to forecast weather for the entire state using the same models that his professional counterparts use. By September 2024, he had built the page to 350,000 followers who trust his forecasts and look to him as an early alarm for natural disasters like hurricanes and tornadoes, particularly in rural areas with less reliable news coverage. That's why, in the days leading up to Helene, when many news outlets were focused on the effect that the storm would have on the Gulf Coast, Clark was warning of the dangers to Western North Carolina. There's a cone of uncertainty, Clark explains, of the prediction of the path of the storm center. A lot of people just look at the cone. They think if they're in the cone, they're getting it. If they're outside the cone, they're not. Most of the mountains were not even in the cone. But Clark knew that the mountains would likely get hit. If they did, it could be catastrophic. He had predicted a pre-event rainfall that would saturate the region on Thursday. The area wouldn't be able to handle much more. From his apartment in Raleigh, he diligently continued warning his audience. Tuesday, September 24th, 4 o'clock p.m. The potential of flash flooding, landslides, and river flooding is increasing across parts of the foothills and mountains. Western North Carolina, I am worried about this much rain. When the National Weather Service Forecast Office Greenville-Spartanburg issued a flash flood warning for much of Western North Carolina on Wednesday, Clark relayed the warning to his Facebook followers. As the storm gained momentum and barreled toward Florida, his posts became more urgent. Wednesday, September 25th, 6:47 p.m. This could be historic. I don't like to say these words often, but it could be historic. As the pre-event rain pelted the western part of the state, Clark reported on the many water rescues already taking place on Wednesday and Thursday. Thursday, September 26th, 11:03 a.m. Wow, an all-time record flooding is expected at Biltmore Village. This is expected to surpass the historic floods of 1916 and 2004. As the storm strengthened, Clark stopped studying for classes and continued sounding the alarm. 6:24 p.m., just in, Hurricane Helene has now rapidly strengthened to an extremely dangerous Cat 4 hurricane with winds of 130 miles per hour and a pressure of 947 millibars based on the latest Hurricane Hunter Pass. A tropical storm to a Cat 4 hurricane in 24 hours? Wow. Major hurricane, 11:29 p.m., major hurricane makes landfall in the Florida Big Bend area as a Cat 4 hurricane with winds of 140 miles per hour and a pressure of 938 millibars. Clark worked to keep calm. Okay, don't get bogged down in predicting exact amounts of rainfall, Clark told himself. Focus on safety. Focus on the bigger picture. There's still a chance for people to get out. Friday, September 27th, 4:41 a.m. Good morning, all. The forecast remains on track, and we're looking over everything right now. We have widespread flash flood warnings for most of western North Carolina. Wind gusts are starting to ramp up across western NC, and nearly 55,000 customers in North Carolina are already without power. There are reports of trees falling from Charlotte west, and wind gusts will continue to increase. As North Carolina began to see the effects of the storm on Friday, Clark posted almost minute-by-minute updates that he received from his audience online. He reported flat power outages, downed trees, wind gusts, flash flood emergencies, do-not-drive alerts, shelter-in-place orders, road closures, wiped-out bridges, mudslides, collapsed buildings. He stayed at his computer for hours on end, guiding his followers through the worst of the storm. When the last of Helene moved out of North Carolina on Friday night, Clark began receiving hundreds of Facebook messages asking about the state of the mountain communities. As the updates arrived, he shared them on his page and requested his followers do the same. Through his large online network, he passed along information on places news teams couldn't access yet. His posts have been credited with saving lives, like this message he received and shared. Saturday, September 28, 11:34 a.m. 100 people stuck on a mountain in Black Mountain, North Carolina. Address is 129 Morning Glory Drive, Black Mountain. They need immediate rescuing. There's a lady giving birth, and they will run out of food in the next day or two. Please help. Sharing this because I really don't know what else to do. I'm trying. North Carolina Department of Public Safety Emergency Management saw the post and sent a rescue team to evacuate the mountain. On the Monday following the storm, Clark reposted a comment from Emily Brewer, who convinced her parents to evacuate Asheville prior to the storm because of his warnings. They wouldn't have survived it, she wrote. Thank you so much. As the news team started to catch up on reporting the storm's aftermath, Clark saw his audience nearly double, and several major news outlets had picked up his story. CBS even arranged for Clark to fly to Atlanta to meet his hero, Jim Cantore of the Weather Channel. Clark is set to graduate in December after failing a statistics class because of the storm, and he plans to go into emergency management or weather consulting or maybe hurricane hunting and flying into storms to collect data. It's a dangerous job, he says, but that's the research that goes into protecting people. No matter what he does, he plans to keep his page active. The people of North Carolina are counting on him. Ray Russell, Ray's Weather from Boone. People in western North Carolina have come to rely on a popular weather forecasting website to help them navigate their everyday lives, especially a year ago when the wind and rain turned deadly. From the monitors in a sparsely decorated office overlooking downtown Boone last fall, weather forecaster Ray Russell saw trouble coming 1,500 miles away. A rotating air mass was forming in the southern Caribbean, and it had the potential to become huge. After 24 years of operating raysweather.com, a longtime mainstay for many in western North Carolina, Russell knew hurricanes forming in that corner of the world could be ferocious. A Boone resident for 33 years, he had seen firsthand that hurricanes could be as dangerous for those living in the mountains as well as on the coast. On Monday morning, September 23rd, he warned readers that a tropical system was coming their way with the potential for flooding, strong winds, and possible tornadoes. By the next day, the system would have a tropical storm designation and a name, Helene. Maya Nelson, office manager at Ray's Weather, could see her boss growing more and more anxious every day. Russell's wife, Rhonda, saw it too, an unsettling level of seriousness in her normally upbeat husband. He was intensely focused on Helene's path through the Caribbean. Passing over Cuba or the Yucatan Peninsula would weaken it, but the storm skirted between them, reaching hurricane strength as it approached the Gulf of Mexico on September 25th. Russell warned readers to nail it down, bring it in, and board it up. His tone got people's attention. Russell's forecasts are written with humor rather than hyperbole to add a bit of levity to the critical information readers depend on for their livelihoods, vacations, and everyday lives. I grew up in a Ray's Weather family, says Ruthie Baker, 28, who lives in Avery County, town of Newland. Before we did anything, my dad would say, "Let's see what Ray says." It's the weather gospel from a man who started as a minister and spent 30 years teaching computer science at Appalachian State University. In 1993, a childhood fascination with weather was rekindled when a blizzard buried Boone in about 36 inches of snow. He started posting snow forecasts on his university website and teaching himself meteorology. For Christmas 1998, Rhonda bought him a weather station, which cost no more than $500. 18 months later, Ray's Weather was a business. Today, it's the most widely read media outlet of any type that originates in northwestern North Carolina. Like most forecasters, Russell and his staff, four part-time meteorologists, analyze data from 10 or so global computer models, but that's not specific enough for the mountains, where lofty peaks and lush valleys create microclimates. Russell's home-cooked forecast incorporates live local data from about 65 weather stations and 25 webcams that Ray's Weather has installed from Hendersonville to southwestern Virginia. Weather connects everyone, he says, from linemen to resort visitors. Everybody's got to interact with the weather, Russell says. My goal for our audience is that they can come to the website, spend 2 to 5 minutes, and get all the information they need. They often get a laugh as well, like when Russell issues a big hair warning on windy days. So last fall, longtime readers knew the situation was bad when he posted, "This is not a drill." Days of rain preceding the hurricane had softened up the region for a body blow. All the streams and rivers were high, and the tree roots were sitting in mush, Russell recalls. It would be flooding from the first drop. Worse yet, an upper-level low-pressure system moving south as Helene moved north increased the potential for torrential rain and wind. On Thursday, he told residents to expect one of the strongest storms ever to hit the region. When the upper-level low-pressure system caught Helene's rotation, the storm catapulted forward. As Helene made landfall in Florida in the early morning hours on Friday, rain and wind were already battering the roof of Russell's mountainside home. Before the power went out, Russell posted one more update from his home office with the title, "Historic and Catastrophic." Countless people would later say Russell's warning spurred them to act, and the credibility he has built in 25 years of forecasting probably saved lives. Yet Russell says he does not have regrets. He does have regrets. He wishes he could have helped with the rescue and recovery, but he couldn't because of what he now faces, vision loss. It's hard to watch him prepare a forecast these days. Glasses off, he hunches his lanky frame forward until his nose nearly touches the oversized monitor, reading and comparing the endless rows and columns of numbers in one computer model and then another before checking radar on yet another oversized monitor. His face is always inches from the screen. But it's like what Russell told his wife. If legendary blind bluegrass picker Doc Watson could wire his own house, I can do this. Whatever day it is, he says, of forecasting the weather, there's somebody it's important to. Helen Chickering, Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Left without power, cell service, or internet for weeks after Helene, Western North Carolinians turned to a reliable source for vital information, radio. The FEMA emergency hotline number is still taped behind her computer monitor. On the walls, posters still catalog the days Asheville went without water. October 7th, day 11, says one. A second poster hangs next to the first, where someone wrote in biblical language, and on the 53rd day, water came back. Across the ceiling, twinkle lights offer a friendly ambiance, and the clock above the recording equipment keeps military time. Helen Chickering, whose 11-year tenure at Blue Ridge Public Radio makes her velvety voice one of the most recognizable in Western North Carolina, and serves as the local host of NPR's Morning Edition from this room every weekday. Though she's been reporting on a range of issues for decades, she's particularly driven by the opportunity to give people context and information they can use to make decisions at pivotal moments, especially in times of collective uncertainty, like during Helene and its aftermath. I remember feeling like we were all so connected, she says of that time. Our job was to figure out how to get people what they needed in these little pockets of information we could deliver. On September 27th, 2024, Chickering arrived at work at 5 a.m., knowing the conditions would be difficult. The day before, the Weather Service had issued warnings with words like catastrophic and life-threatening. But she couldn't have prepared for the reality coming her way. In a matter of hours, the region would lose power, internet, and eventually water. Reports were coming in real time. It was such sloppy radio, she remembers. I was interrupting myself to say, hold on, we've got a new information coming through. We were learning as we were broadcasting. The BPR studio became a refuge for reporters far and wide, from the station's regular journalists to NPR's national team to local outlets and other publications using the brick and mortar as a port in the storm. This floor has seen a lot of tears, Chickering says of her recording space. Reporters would sit on the floor. We'd all listen to the stories they'd collected and processed together. Local reporters would file their pieces and then return to their makeshift home base at BPR Studios, sit with Chickering behind the mic, and share those stories with listeners. She specifically remembers a report from Fairview where the subject of the interview had begun removing pets and important personal documents from his own home before he saw a landslide bury his neighbor's. He described watching his neighbor narrowly escape from her house with mud up to her chest, sobbing and knocking on his door, begging for help. Excuse me. Apologize for my voice today. Twice daily for weeks after Helene made landfall, BPR featured press briefings wherein city and county officials communicated information to an eager public, many of whom were still without power. The only hope to receive any official reporting was to use a crank radio, if listeners were lucky enough to have one, or to use precious battery or gasoline as they listened in their cars. Chickering's soothing voice leading into and following those briefings provided unspeakable comfort to listeners as she recapped critical sections of the announcements for those who might have missed them. So much of our reporting during that time was simply, what do you need, she says. Chickering is eager to credit her fellow BPR reporters and news outlets at large for their round-the-clock work to gather the information that would help people most. The amazing teamwork that was happening, all the support we were getting from nearby communities on national radio, it was so beautiful, she says. People sometimes view national public radio primarily as a news source, but we're community public radio. For so many days following the storm, she continues, though there were some tourists who got stuck here, it was otherwise very local, and it connected us. Neighbors met neighbors. Communities bonded. Our region rose to the challenge. I hope our listeners felt that we were with them. Tomorrow, Chickering will arrive at her usual at work at her usual 5 a.m. She'll settle in, turn on her microphone, and report out to her listeners as we navigate school drop-offs and commutes, our cars full of once scarce gasoline. We'll be listening in the background as we switch on the lights, power restored to our homes, and newly reopened businesses. Her voice will be with us to help us through the day, whatever it may hold. Switching gears for a moment, on our last article is called A Taste of Tradition. For generations, the North Carolina State Fair has served up food, fun, and a helping of homegrown pride. And you may want to note this. The North Carolina State Fair in Raleigh is from October 16th through the 26th this year. That's why I wanted to go ahead and bring this article forward now. So we've got it's almost a little bit of a photo essay here. From humble roots to a million-strong crowd, the North Carolina State Fair has been on a long, wild ride. And there's a black-and-white photo of two ladies sharing a foot-long hot dog at the North Carolina State Fair in October 1955. The vendor Charlie Barefoot and Son, still selling hot dogs at the fair today, had introduced the delicacy 6 years earlier. And on the facing page, we have an aerial view looking down at the fairgrounds. It's hard for me to tell what perspective because I don't see the Dorton Arena in this photo, so I don't know where we are. And then there are some different program brochures, vintage program brochures from the different eras, some of them dating back as late as 1894. When the fair began in the mid-19th century, nearly 90% of North Carolinians worked in agriculture. The event was created to showcase best practices across the industry. Farming remains at the heart of the fair, a tradition kept alive through decades of booths, exhibits, and competitions, even as rides, games, and concessions have, in later years, taken center stage. So we have a couple of black and white photos here highlighting tomatoes in this particular photo. We have a couple of vintage membership cards from the season ticket holders of the State Fair and from 1923 and 1922, and a Stanley County poultry demonstration booth that is from farm to fun is the little theme of this. And the fair has expanded from farm exhibits to high-octane fun and food, yet still brings together North Carolinians of all ages each fall. Thrilling rides, drag races, and demolition derbies have been crowd favorites for fairgoers across the years, like this group of students from NC State in the 1980s, and that's a black-and-white photo as well. I guess it was maybe... not originally black and white, and then we have some kids today who are riding a ride with their hands up in the air, being brave, from 2024. The top photo shows demolition derby photograph. And State Fair by the numbers, this is kind of an interesting little insight here. The cost of admission to the first North Carolina State Fair was 25 cents. A one is the number of years since the fair held an ostrich race. 15 is the number of years since 1853 that the fair has not been held due to the Civil War, disbanding of the Agricultural Society, World War II, and then most recently the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic. Now, the number is 246,779. It's the all-time record for pounds of food donated by fairgoers to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina on Food Lion Hunger Relief Day, and that was set in 2010. Four, the number of U.S. presidents who have attended the State Fair, Theodore Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Gerald Ford, and George H.W. Bush. And there's a picture there of President Harry Truman, who attended the fair with Governor R. Gregg Cherry in 1948. And it shows a picture of the permanent buildings that run along Hillsborough Street there in the background. 344 is the number of acres the fair spans today. 72 is the number of new food items debuted at the fair last year. 1 million, the number of fairgoers that visit Raleigh anticipates in 2025. For many fairgoers, like the McCarthy family shown in this issue, food is the main draw. Vendors from across North Carolina serve traditions as beloved as the fair itself. And it's funny, this family is decked out in a costume showing food. Mom is a hamburger. Dad is a hot dog. The two of the kids are French fries, and one is a slushie. I'll run through a brief history of the North Carolina State Fair. 1853, the first North Carolina State Fair, held on 16 acres near New Bern Avenue in Raleigh, lasted for 4 days. In the early years, foods were mostly preserves, pies, cakes, and smoked meats entered for exhibitions rather than as concessions. In 1873, the fair moved to the new, larger location on Hillsborough Street. 1879, the first North Carolina State Colored Industrial Association Fair opens in Raleigh to promote black industry and education. The event hosted agricultural and industrial displays, parades, and speeches until its final run in 1930. 1884, it's electric. Power comes to the fair. 1891, the first ride, the Switchback Railway roller coaster, is built, signaling a new focus on amusement. 1895, the main attraction of the year, chicken incubators. 1900, churches and civic groups open the first food booths and sell homemade goods. 1916, Cary United Methodist Church introduces its ham biscuit, kicking off a tradition that fed generations of hungry visitors until the booth shut down in 2022. 1928, the fair moves to its current location on Blue Ridge Road. 1930s, the modern Midway opens with the fair's first carnival-style attractions. 1949, Charlie Barefoot begins selling foot-long hot dogs. Brightleaf, of course. 1950, a fair of the future. Model on display in the main hall unveils plans for a new coliseum, eventually named the J.S. Dorton Arena, which would open 2 years later. 1957, one of the year's most popular exhibits, Know the Meats You Buy, educates fairgoers on cuts of beef, pork, and lamb. 1965, white and black 4-H groups compete together for the first time. 1978, the NC State Food Science Club serves its first ice cream cone. 1985, the Whole Hog Barbecue Championship is introduced. Willis Peden and Jim Elder from Havelock take home the blue ribbon. 2019, the largest traveling Ferris wheel in North America, the Skygazer, debuts. It towers 155 feet above the fairgrounds, and riders take in views of more than 15 miles from its peak. 2020, the pandemic cancels the in-person fair, but drive-through and walk-up food booths dish out favorites like funnel cakes and turkey legs. And then 2025, this year's fair runs 10 days from October 16th through the 26th. On weekdays, visitors can enjoy free lunchtime admission from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. And your reader here will tell you that if you want to participate in that, be sure to look up their website to find out where you can enter and exit and what the conditions are for that free lunchtime admission. Well, that sounds means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.